Some potentially good news on the question of coronavirus immunity.
Everybody who's exposed to this virus seems to create antibodies.
But do antibodies equal protection?
There, the jury is very much out.
I'm Marco Werman. We untangle acquired immunity today on the show. Also, a maternity ward in Kabul loses any sense of joy or celebration.
It's shocking, it's heartbreaking, it's terrifying that there are targets for just living their day-to-day life.
And in Japan, people are being lured out of lockdown by pachinko, the game that's more addictive than the coronavirus is scary. And in France, COVID-19 gets assigned a gender, while medical masks stir up controversy. Those stories and more today on The World. Let's start today taking stock of where we are in the struggle against the coronavirus. Since the virus first made itself known this winter, more than 4.3 million people have been infected across the globe. Nearly 300,000 people have lost their lives. Those numbers, according to Johns Hopkins. As scientists race to understand this new virus, the question of immunity looms large over their work. Are people who have been infected with the coronavirus protected from getting sick again? And if they are, how long will that immunity last? The World's Carolyn Beeler reports that we don't know these answers yet, but scientists are starting to put the pieces of the puzzle together, largely by studying people's blood.
So, which arm do you usually use?
My right arm.
Okay, can I see
my right
that?
Hand.
Yes.
Answering the question of whether and for how long people who have had COVID-19 are immune starts with this, a blood draw.
I'm just inserting the needle. Okay, and we are in the vein now.
I'm sitting on a bench outside of a Harvard research building with a phlebotomist named Shamila.
I'm putting the tube. Okay, and now the blood is coming.
I'm not sure if I've ever been exposed to the new coronavirus, but I was curious to find out if I could. So I volunteered a while back for this clinical trial that looks for antibodies in people's blood.
You're good at that. Didn't hurt very much.
The goal of the study is twofold. First, to get a better sense of how many people in the general population were infected and didn't even know it. And second, to track how long these antibodies last in people's blood. This is one of many studies like it running all around the world, and there are some interesting results already coming out of New York with a study launched in March.
More or less, everybody who's exposed to this virus seems to create antibodies. This is really reassuring because it likely has implications for risk of reinfection.
Mais Mansour is a primary care doctor at Mount Sinai Hospital. She co-authored a not-yet-peer-reviewed study published last week that could be considered a first piece in the puzzle of COVID-19 immunity. Her team tested 624 patients who'd previously tested positive for the virus, and they found all but three had antibodies against it in their blood. That's regardless of their age, gender, or how severe their COVID-19 symptoms were. Mansour says that's new.
One of the concerns that we had was whether or not you'd have to be really sick to create these antibodies at a detectable level. And, you know, fortunately, we found that regardless of how sick you were, you did create antibodies. So that was a good thing.
But the real question is, does that antibody response provide you with longer-term protection against the disease?
John Bell is a professor of medicine at Oxford in the UK, asking the question on everyone's mind.
And there, the jury is very much out.
That's another piece of the puzzle. If this virus behaves like most other viruses, antibodies should protect people from reinfection for at least some period of time. Right now, scientists are working to confirm that in labs by exposing live virus to antibodies to see if it's inactivated. The next piece of the puzzle will be figuring out how long any immunity might last. Dr. Clemens Ventner says based on what we know about immunity from SARS and MERS, two cousins to the current coronavirus, it should last months or maybe years.
But at this point, this is pure speculation.
Ventner is the head of the infectious disease department at a hospital in Munich. He's been tracking a cluster of nine COVID-19 patients infected way back in January. And he told me last month,
we know for sure that our patients are still healthy.
Ventner says it's likely those patients have already been re-exposed to the coronavirus. but he doesn't know how long they might be immune.
That's correct. I mean, we will not know until a reinfection occurs in a couple of patients.
Or when antibodies in blood samples start to drop off below whatever the protective level turns out to be. This clinical trial I donated blood to will take samples regularly for the next 2 years. The idea is to learn whether antibodies do in fact protect people from reinfection, and for how long. But luckily, natural immunity isn't the only thing to hang our hopes on right now. Oxford University scientist Sarah Gilbert says the vaccine her team is testing will work a little differently than the virus itself.
So we could be in a situation which would be very fortunate. We could find that the vaccine-induced immunity lasts a lot longer than the infection-induced immunity.
Okay, you're all set.
Back on the bench outside the Harvard building, my blood draw wraps up after about 2 painless minutes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. Have a good day.
I should learn in about 10 days whether I'm one of the countless people who's been exposed to the novel coronavirus without knowing it. And maybe my blood will help fill in one tiny piece of the puzzle of COVID-19 immunity. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler in Boston.
Scientists around the world are trying to understand the basics of how the coronavirus works. Governments around the world are tackling a different question, how to safely reopen their economies while the virus is still with us. That's except for one country that never closed, Sweden. Its bars, restaurants, and shops have stayed open. Big manufacturers like Volvo and Ericsson are still trying to churn out goods. But it has not been easy. Christina Nyman is chief economist at Handelsbanken, one of Sweden's largest banks. She joins us from Stockholm. Let's talk big picture for a second, Christina. How's Sweden's economy doing right now?
The Swedish economy is really suffering from the corona crisis, even though it's not been locked down the same way as other countries. And we have a huge increase in unemployment. So we are really worried here as well.
And what would you point to in the current downturn that's linked to the pandemic? I'm thinking about big Swedish companies like Volvo and Ericsson, which are dependent on supply chains in other countries, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So for Sweden, I mean, we have not closed down the same way, and we have a good public finances, but at the same time, we are very export dependent. And with a large motor vehicle industry, that means that we have been severely hit. We see a huge increase in layoffs. I mean, from the beginning, it was mainly from the service sectors, but now we can see it broadly and also in the manufacturing. And we have seen, I mean, unemployment will increase in the same amount as in other countries. And we have like around almost 1 million people now either laid off or notice a layoff.
I see that Sweden's death rate from COVID-19 far surpasses other Scandinavian countries, triple the death rate for Denmark, Finland, Norway combined. Are Swedes saying that this is a serious downside to the stay-open approach?
The numbers especially probably comes from elder care, where we have high death numbers. They say that it's still too early to say if the rest of the Nordic countries will manage to have the virus not creating deaths and so on when they start to open up. But of course, especially the death numbers for elderly is something that's very unfortunate.
As an economist at a large bank, have you been personally dismayed by Sweden's approach?
No. I think many of us, and me as well, think it's a kind of reasonable way of dealing with it. I mean, there are still a lot of social distancing out on the streets in Stockholm, for example. There are very little people out. And if you use public transport, you're almost alone. And everyone almost is working from home that can.
Despite the aim of keeping the economy open, though, Sweden's economy, as you say, is still taking a big hit. Do you think it's going to get worse? And do you think the economic pain the rest of Europe is going through will eventually land in Sweden?
Yeah, I mean, it is bad here. And if we are so dependent on what's happening in the rest of the world, then we will continue to have problems. But if the European economy starts to open up a bit, it can ease a little bit for us as well. But we do expect unemployment to be much higher than we had before the crisis, even like 2 or 3 years ahead.
I'm wondering, Christina, considering you're from a country that did not shut down, can you offer any economic advice to countries that have shut down and are figuring out now how to reopen?
What we are doing is that we are not reopening, so we are more or less continuing the same kind of business. But I guess it's very important to be very clear what social distancing means, especially for these groups that are especially vulnerable.
I got to ask you, Christina, have you been wearing a mask? Have you been social distancing? Are we talking to you from your home?
you're talking from my home, but I'm not wearing a mask when I'm out. I am wearing a mask when I talk to my mother, but otherwise not. But I try to stay away from not getting too close to people.
Kristina Nyman is chief economist at the Swedish bank Handelsbanken. She's been speaking with us from Stockholm. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The European Union outlined a plan for a limited reopening today. It suggests countries with similar coronavirus infection rates relax restrictions on cross-border travel. Part of the goal is to salvage the summer tourist season, but the plan is just a suggestion. Countries will be deciding what to do for themselves. And like with the states here, regional groupings are setting the pace, including what's been dubbed the Baltic bubble. The world's Indra Ekmanis joins me for more. So what countries are we talking about, Indra, and how are they coping with COVID-19 right now?
Right. So the Baltic countries are Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. They're up in the northeast corner of the European Union, right across from Sweden and Finland on the Baltic Sea. And together they have a population of about 6 million. And they've actually had quite a lot of success dealing with the pandemic. The Latvian Minister of Health, Ilze Vinkele, even had the chance to guest DJ a quarantine disco last week to lighten the mood.
Wow, Latvia's Minister of Health sounds pretty hip.
Yeah, she does. But in all seriousness, yeah, the Baltic countries have taken a pretty proactive approach to the pandemic. They issued emergency measures early on before anyone had died of the disease. They've been testing pretty aggressively. And in large part, experts and scientists rather than politicians have kind of been the guiding force. Estonia did have a pretty big outbreak on one of its islands, Saaremaa, which is now kind of being referred to as Corona Island. But Estonia and Lithuania have seen between 1,500 and 1,700 cases and around 60 deaths each. In Latvia, it's less than 1,000 cases and just 19 deaths. And they were also able to manage without a hard lockdown. So businesses could stay open if they could maintain social distancing and other precautions. And people took it pretty seriously.
So, Indra, what is this bubble of Baltic states proposing to do now in terms of opening up?
So starting on Friday, the countries are going to open their borders for free travel within the Baltics. That means people can hop in their car in Tallinn and drive the 4 hours down to Riga in Latvia or down to Vilnius in Lithuania. But anyone coming from outside of the three countries will still have to go through a two-week quarantine period. But opening up travel is a big step in the return to normal, their prime ministers say. And, you know, the Baltic countries have a lot of shared history and common interests. So they've traditionally had a pretty strong regional sense of cooperation.
Yeah, so open to each other, but keeping others out. I guess that's why they call this the bubble, the Baltic bubble. The Baltics also have this reputation for innovation. Would you say this is part of that tradition, Indra?
Definitely. You know, Estonia is a hyper-digital society. We're connecting on Skype, Marco, and that was partially developed in Estonia.
Right.
And the country has also kind of pioneered a digital way of approaching its problems. It hosted a coronavirus hackathon to come up with some creative solutions. Lithuania turned its airport into a drive-in movie theater, and the capital is kind of turning into this open-air cafe so people can visit their favorite restaurants while still keeping their distance. And of course, you know, online quarantine discos in Latvia. So they've definitely been taking on this crisis in inventive ways. And that's pretty characteristic of the Baltics.
Yeah, continuing the innovation even through the pandemic. The world's Indra Ekmanis, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
This is The World.
The World's supporters include Subtitle, a podcast about how we speak.
All of human languages are products of human brains and bodies.
We talk with comedians, politicians, anyone who thinks about language. Alien languages, too.
If I were a sphere with 9 eyes or 9 sensory organs placed around my diameter, how would that affect things?
Subtitle. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It has been a violent week in Afghanistan. Yesterday, gunmen burst into a maternity hospital in Kabul and killed 2 dozen people. In another part of the country, a suicide attack at a funeral left at least 32 people dead. All of this comes at a time when the Taliban and the Afghan government are supposed to be negotiating a peace deal. The World's Shirin Jafari has the story.
mothers, infants, and hospital workers. They were some of the people killed at the maternity hospital in Kabul on Tuesday. This hospital employee spoke with Afghan reporters. She says she had just welcomed new patients earlier that morning. A few hours later, they were all dead. I wish I'd never admitted them, she says. I just wish I hadn't. The twin attacks in Kabul and Nangarhar province have left many Afghans in shock. Hadi Marifat directs the Afghanistan Human Rights and Democracy Organization. Marifat says the coronavirus lockdown in Kabul might explain why the assailants targeted a hospital.
Kabul is locked down and there are not many gatherings of the people that they could go and target. So the hospital was the only somehow place with a lot of people there to be attacked and killed.
The Taliban denied it was responsible for Tuesday's attacks. Marifat says blame is shifting towards the Islamic State.
But we know that such kind of attack cannot be carried out without some sort of support from the Taliban.
Other experts I talk with agree. They say the Taliban and the Islamic State affiliate in Afghanistan often work together. And here's why this is important. Back in February, the United States reached an agreement with the Taliban. The longtime enemies signed a deal that promised to pave the way for peace in Afghanistan. But since then, the Taliban has continued to carry out attacks, dozens of them every day. Last week, the U.S. said it would no longer report the number of insurgent attacks in Afghanistan.
We are not pleased with the level of violence in Afghanistan.
Jonathan Hoffman, a spokesman at the Defense Department, explained why.
We're working toward a better solution and a better place for Afghanistan, and that the sharing of that information would not move that ball forward. And so,
this is concerning for members of the Afghan government. They say the U.S. is turning a blind eye to the atrocities of the Taliban. Mariam Soliman Khail is a member of Afghanistan's parliament.
The hundreds of attacks have happened on Afghan citizens since the deal has been signed. So in the agreement, they said there would be a reduction of violence, but it has yet to happen.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said yesterday that his government is not going to stay silent. He ordered security forces to begin an offensive against extremist groups. Soliman Khail supports the president's decision.
People are dying when we're in a defensive nature. So if we can become offensive, maybe it'll give us some hope.
Soliman Khail says Afghans want peace with the Taliban, but the Taliban has to meet them halfway. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In France, people are required to wear a mask outside right now, but it is still against the law for women to cover their faces for religious reasons, the so-called burqa ban. A French official recently confirmed that law will still be enforced during the pandemic. Rimsara Alouane is a law researcher in Toulouse. It's been a decade that France has upheld this so-called burqa ban, Rimsara. Remind us what the law is and why its supporters think it's needed.
Actually, the law is the prohibition of concealment of the face in public. Unless, and the devil is in the details, unless you do it for health or professional motives, so a surgical mask is perfectly fine, or if the concealment is part of, and I quote the law here, sport activities, celebrations, or artistic or traditional events, meaning you can conceal your face unless it's a Muslim type of concealment.
What is the punishment for Muslim women wearing a face covering for religious reasons in France? How is that enforced?
Usually you are fined. It's a 150 euro fine. If you wear a niqab for face covering, you right. also need to pass a sort of training to learn about the, you know, the values of the Republic. Today, I think the biggest question is, what does it mean to live together in a society where you have no choice but to cover your face? And how Muslim women who wear that type of garment would be more of a danger than people wearing a surgical mask in terms of public order risk.
Do you think coronavirus may impact this ongoing debate about religious face coverings in France?
No. Even though some people, especially activists, people thought that we are going to finally see the hypocrisy behind the full face covering ban. Again, it was the law was precisely designed, built to target a certain category of people. They already made sure that the exception could be implemented. It shouldn't come as a surprise for people that this law will never be abolished, because it will not.
You're Muslim, Rem Sara. How does this all impact you personally?
Well, full disclosure, I don't wear a hijab or a niqab, so obviously I guess I'm not affected as much as those who do. But regardless your religion, your culture, your political belief, your philosophical belief, you need to understand that once the government, public authorities, try to infringe, limit, target your rights as a human being, you can be sure that those infringements will apply later to another group of people, et cetera, until your civil liberties are completely weakened. And it's funny because right now with the issue about, you know, having a tracing app, civil liberties again are put at stake. So as a Muslim, as a citizen, as a woman, I say, be careful. It's in a time of crisis that civil liberties and human rights should be protected, even more than during, you know, a normal time. And I'm kind of worried that today we would trade blindly our civil liberties for more security, even though you will not get more security if you don't have your civil liberties protected. So yes, we should be careful. We should really be careful. And it's not just France, really. I think on that matter, it's really across the world.
Mm. Rem Sara Alouane is a law researcher in Toulouse. Rem Sara, I know you were showing symptoms of COVID-19 but could not get tested. We are glad you are on the mend, and thank you very much for speaking with us. And Ramadan Mubarak to you.
Shukran. Thank you. Merci. And thanks for having me. Keep up the good work. Your work is essential, especially right now.
You spend time with the world every weekday to hear voices that connect you to faraway people and places. That connection continues on social media 24/7. Join the conversation about stories that keep you thinking. We've got a brand new handle on Twitter, and it's easier than ever to remember. We're at The World. Or hit me up. I'm at Marco Werman. News headlines are just ahead. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Israel today. He had on a red, white, and blue face mask and was talking about the annexation of the West Bank.
It's, if anything, more of a priority for the Trump administration than for this divided Israeli government in the next few months.
That and more still ahead here on The World. The mortality rate from COVID-19 continues to rise around the world. Officials and scientists are in overdrive searching for a cure. The island nation of Madagascar says it has already found one. The country has only had 200 coronavirus cases and zero deaths. The world's Halima Gakandi tells us that story.
The amber-colored drink comes in a clear bottle. It's called COVID Organics. It was introduced last month by a state-run lab in Madagascar. Officials say the herbal drink's main ingredient comes from the plant Artemisia annua, also known as sweet wormwood. Professor Chris Nahos researches traditional medicine at Northwest University in South Africa. She says Artemisia annua is a well-known plant.
It's a very popular herbal medicine. It's one of the most frequently used herbal medicines in parts of the world.
The plant is also known in scientific circles. It contains an ingredient called artemisinin, which is widely used to treat malaria. According to Host, it's not the only African herbal remedy with commercial uses.
There are quite a few prescribed Western medicines that have their source in African herbal remedies.
She points to the chemotherapy drugs derived from the Madagascar periwinkle as an example. But let's be clear. There's currently no evidence that the Artemisia annua plant or its derivatives can effectively treat the new coronavirus. That hasn't stopped Madagascar's president, Andry Rajoelina, from promoting it. On Monday, he told a French news agency that the drink was not only a prevention for COVID-19, but a cure.
COVID Organics, needless to say, is a preventative and curative remedy against COVID-19. It works very well.
President Rajoelina says 80% of Madagascar's population uses traditional medicines like this one. So far, the government has already handed out the drink to schools and donated it to other countries. Last week, Tanzania's foreign minister, Palamagamba Kabudi, flew to Madagascar to accept boxes of the herbal tonic.
Madagascar is providing, is contributing a solution to a global problem.
But scientists around the world are sounding the alarm. During a recent press conference, the World Health Organization's Africa director, Matshidiso Moeti, said any new treatment needs to be tested first.
We would caution and advise against countries adopting a product which has not been taken through tests to see its efficacy against COVID-19.
On Tuesday, the WHO met with 70 African traditional medicine experts to discuss the possible role that traditional medicine could play in the coronavirus pandemic. They all agreed that medicines need to go through clinical trials first. Professor Chris Nahos says it's important to treat African traditional remedies like any other potential medical treatment.
You should ask the same questions as with any medicines developed in a laboratory. You need to know that it's proven effective for the specific medical application. You must know it has been proven safe for consumption.
A U.S. company has partnered with a German institute to test whether the same Artemisia annua plant could be effective against coronavirus. But President Rajoelina of Madagascar says there's no time to waste on testing. The proof, he says, is in the coronavirus patients who were allegedly cured within 7 to 10 days of taking the herbal remedy.
The vast majority of patients were treated with this remedy are all the proof you need that it works. No one has died in Madagascar. No one has died.
The African Union says it needs to see more scientific data about this herbal drink from Madagascar. Then the African Centers for Disease Control can review the information to see if it's effective. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Food supply chains are being disrupted all over the world. In East Africa, it's not just the pandemic screwing things up. Heavy rains during the most recent harvest and an ongoing locust outbreak devastated crops. Then open-air food markets were closed to help prevent the spread of the coronavirus. All of that creates major concerns over food security. In Kenya, officials say around 12 million people don't have enough food right now. Timothy Njagi is an expert in food security at Egerton University in Nairobi. We've all seen some of the videos of these swarms of locusts devastating fields, millions of insects eating pretty much everything in sight, even without COVID. How bad has this year been for herders and farmers, Timothy?
We have yet to establish the precise effects for what has happened. But I think, as you've seen even in the pictures, this is the worst locust invasion we've had in the country this year, because we had above average rainfall in most parts of the country. There was going to be adequate pasture were it not for the locust invasion. Farmers were expecting to have more in terms of production for both meat and milk. But right now, they're struggling because there is less pasture.
Timothy, it sounds like you're in lockdown, judging from the children in the background. Just curious, as a food security expert in Kenya, how hard does it make your job to not be able to go out in the field?
Actually, it is quite difficult, because some of the information that we get, sometimes you have to verify. Because sometimes, especially when respondents know how you're going to use information, there's likelihood of exaggeration. But then also in some areas, we still cannot get information on what is happening in those areas.
So what limitations has COVID-19 actually put on food producers, and how has it made it harder to fight the locusts?
So for the locusts, the major strategy the government has gone with is to use chemical pesticides. And most of these chemical pesticides are not manufactured locally, so they have to be imported from outside. In March, we lost like 2 to 3 weeks because of the challenges in logistics. For food supply, again, we had a similar shock, because Kenya announced the restrictions in mid-March. Immediately after that, we saw some local governments closing markets.
You're talking about like outdoor informal markets, right?
Yes, yes. Like 85% of our food goes through those outdoor informal markets. What happened was that some markets were closed. Some of these markets are very key distribution points, especially in the urban areas. This means that for producers, it's a terrible place to be, especially for farmers who are doing fresh fruits and vegetables and other perishable commodities like dairy, because you cannot store it. For the consumers, it means that you're likely to pay slightly more because there's a perceived, some artificial shortage in the supply.
For Kenyans who could not afford to pay more for food, what have they been eating?
So one of the challenges we've had for the COVID is that, people have also lost jobs. What we've seen was a lot of individuals doing a lot of charitable work. And then this quickly spreads to the civil society organizations, and now the government as well is also distributing food. So right now it's more just an immediate response. So it's just very short term, but we do hope that even as we go to the post-COVID period, we'll be able to map out areas where people need more support in terms of access to food. And then we can have like structured interventions.
So planting season is happening now. Are farmers worried about next year?
We are really worried about next year, especially if the current crisis prolongs into summer. We import quite a number of inputs, including seed and fertilizer. And if the current scenarios persist, then we are really worried, because that's going to constrain access to inputs. Labor has also been a challenge right now. And one of the other problems is that, agriculture in Kenya is highly labor intensive. So that has also been affected. So when you have constraint in labor and transportation, that really affects your efficiency even when you're trying to produce.
Timothy Njagi is a research fellow at Egerton University in Nairobi. Thank you very much for telling us about the food situation there. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Michael.
Japan remains in a state of emergency to stop the coronavirus. Most Japanese are following orders to stay inside, but there's one attraction that some people in Japan just can't stay away from. It's a game, one so addictive that even in the middle of a pandemic, people are leaving their lockdowns to play it. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Pachinko. It's hard to describe. Just imagine if a pinball machine and a slot machine had a baby. A baby that is really loud. To play, you buy a bunch of tiny metal balls, like ball bearings, and feed them into what looks like a slot machine. Then you twist a dial, and the balls shoot into the machine and bounce around, like a pinball machine, but it's vertical. You want the balls to fall into the right slot, because if that happens, jackpot. It starts bleeping and jingling like crazy and spitting out an absurd amount of balls, which you can then redeem for prizes, like snacks or electronics or toys. Or you can exchange them for cash, because, yeah, it's gambling.
Pachinko is basically same as slot machines.
Ichiro Tanioka is president of the Osaka University of Commerce. He says the pachinko industry is gambling, but since gambling is illegal in Japan, the government can't call it that.
By law, police department keeps saying pachinko is just fun game.
A fun game that can be pretty addictive. So addictive that some guys, yes, it's mostly men, are ignoring the government's request to stay home during the pandemic. They just gotta go out and hit the pachinko parlor.
Usually, Japanese are very obedient, and if government asks, they follow. But pachinko parlor decided to continue opening the store.
See, it's hard for Japan's government to force any shop to close or force people to stay home. The Constitution was written after World War II, after America took over Japan and added rules to make sure the government could never become too authoritarian.
Governments ask, actually beg, to close down all the stores, but pachinko parlor didn't follow the request.
Well, many parlors closed, but not all. The ones that are going rogue, they have a lot of Japanese people angry. Especially people who see dudes piling into a pachinko joint, potentially infecting each other. Here's a clip that went viral, a guy berating a long line of customers waiting for a pachinko parlor to open. It's easy to get mad at pachinko players. They make easy targets.
They're already not necessarily in the graces of polite society.
That's Michael Penn, an American who's lived in Japan for more than 20 years. He's the executive editor of Asia Gaming Brief, which looks at trends in the pachinko industry.
If you believe, and there's certainly a lot of evidence for this, that pachinko is gambling and that a certain proportion of the customers are gambling addicts, well, there's obviously another big factor.
Walk into a pachinko parlor, you will see rows and rows of machines, maybe even players sitting elbow to elbow, many of them chain smoking. It sounds like a 1980s arcade, but there's no kids and usually less joy.
It's sort of a haven for middle-aged men to go and smoke and play and to kind of lose themselves from this trance.
In fact, if you ask a reputable person like Mr. Tanioka, the president of a university, do you like to play pachinko?
Do I? I don't like.
They may sound taken aback.
I don't play because too noisy and sometimes too smoky. I don't like those environment, so I don't play.
But a lot of people do. This is not some fringe thing. There are fewer than 1 million slot machines in America, but there are more than 4 million pachinko or pachinko-esque machines in Japan. And Japan is a smaller country. Some estimates say the amount of money going into the industry is equal to 4% of Japan's GDP. 4%.
The amount of money which circulates through the machines is a jaw-dropping figure.
We're talking $200 billion per year. But pachinko has seen better days. Most young people would rather stare at their phones than pay to stare at some machine. Michael Penn says this decline means many shops are scared to close right now, even briefly.
These companies, which are already on the edge of bankruptcy, may get pushed over the ledge.
In fact, if a parlor does stay open, they get extra business because their more responsible rivals are not open. But what about public shame? What if reporters show up to the pachinko parlor, like this news crew did recently in the city of Sendai, filming in the parking lot? Well, Michael Penn, the pachinko industry analyst, he says that just lets the hardcore gamers know that some shops are still open.
The defiant companies may, in a morally dubious way, be benefiting economically from their social irresponsibility.
Parts of Japan are now looking to relax the state of emergency, which means more pachinko joints could open soon. Whether the more casual players will come out, choosing to pack into a smoky parlor with strangers during a pandemic, that remains to be seen. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
With a star-spangled mask covering his face, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Israel today for a lightning visit. The official focus of his talks with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was Iran and the coronavirus, but Pompeo did not miss the opportunity to take a swipe at China.
You're a great partner. You share information, unlike some other countries that try and obfuscate and hide that information. And we'll talk about that country, too.
Unofficially, though, Pompeo's visit focused on Israeli plans to annex large parts of the West Bank. Netanyahu says the plans are subject to U.S. agreement. Pompeo says it's up to the Israelis to decide. And both sides are pushing to move forward on the issue. Dan Shapiro is a former U.S. ambassador to Israel under President Obama. So what does it actually mean for both sides, for the Israelis and for the Palestinians?
Well, it's a plan that actually has no chance of ever being implemented as the president presented it. There's no Palestinian leader and virtually no support among the Palestinian public for a plan that would leave the West Bank carved up into disconnected chunks that have really none of the elements of a sovereign state. So there's not ever going to actually be negotiations around this plan. The part that's implementable in the near term and the part they seem to be pushing for is for Israel to annex 30% of the West Bank, the Jordan Valley, and all the West Bank settlements. And that would have the effect of Israel controlling in a sovereign way territory that essentially makes the West Bank a kind of a Swiss cheese map.
So no negotiations. Palestinians are not at the table. And according to the State Department, Pompeo came to Israel by invitation of Netanyahu, plans to bring annexation to a vote as soon as July 1st. So why the rush?
There's a new Israeli government that will be sworn in tomorrow, just power-sharing government between Prime Minister Netanyahu and his main rival, the Blue and White Party. The Prime Minister does have the authority to bring up the annexation issue as early as July 1st. Now, they have said there is a joint committee between the United States and Israel to determine a mapping process to figure out exactly what areas Israel would annex. But it's a very technical process. The United States has committed to support 30%, but there will certainly be some Israelis who will advocate more. And so I don't think they're going to be able to do this by July 1st. But I do think that President Trump would like to see some form of annexation take place sometime before the election. There's no groundswell of support for Israeli annexation in the American public or even in the American Jewish community. And there's a lot of mainstream opposition. But it is popular among some parts of President Trump's base, certain evangelical voters and right-wing members of the Jewish community. And President Trump seems to be focused on trying to excite and energize that base so that they'll come out in large numbers in November. It's, if anything, more of a priority for the Trump administration than for this divided Israeli government to proceed with annexation in the next few months.
Over the past 24 hours, European leaders have said they're considering economic sanctions on Israel if they move ahead with annexation, but it sounds like you don't see this actually going forward.
I don't see it going forward by July 1st. If the Israeli government takes some time to try to determine these technicalities, which again are very complicated, and that process slides into August, September, much closer to the American election, they have to grapple with another concern. That is that Vice President Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, and virtually all Democrats have expressed opposition to unilateral annexation. So this is a somewhat risky move to take a step that has really no international support except from the Trump administration in what could be the final weeks of the administration.
So to put it in blunt terms, Ambassador, regardless of when unilateral annexation would happen, Israel would get everything it wants and the Palestinians don't get anything they want. Where does that leave the Palestinians?
In fact, there are some Israelis who think that the Trump plan is insufficient, that what they really want is to reject even the notional idea of a Palestinian state. But it's very likely that the Palestinian Authority would find it difficult to sustain itself in the years to come. It wouldn't necessarily collapse overnight. But it will soon undergo a leadership transition. President Mahmoud Abbas is in his mid-80s. He's not in great health. And when a new leader emerges, it would be very difficult, perhaps, for that leader to justify sustaining a Palestinian Authority that is not on the pathway toward independence. Mm-hmm. That creates this situation of a binational state with roughly equivalent Jewish and Arab populations. It's not likely to be a very stable environment or really healthy for either of them. But that's the direction that unilateral annexation leads to.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel Dan Shapiro, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
It's official. COVID-19 is feminine in the French language. It's la COVID-19, not le COVID. Yes, it is time for a little French lesson. As with most other Romance languages, every noun in French has its own gender. And the body that polices the language, l'Académie Française, was sick of people waffling between the masculine and feminine when talking about the disease. L'Académie is a centuries-old secretive club led by men, exclusively until 1980. They're known as the Immortals, and they dictate the grammar of the French language. Their reasoning for making COVID-19 female makes sense. They say that because COVID-19 stands for the coronavirus disease of 2019, and the word for disease in French is feminine, la maladie, therefore so is COVID-19. So we get la COVID-19. Interestingly enough, if you wanted to say the coronavirus, that is masculine, le virus. Apparently, Quebec had been using the correct form all along. As for the rest of you francophones who've been saying le COVID, l'Académie Française wants you to know that they are not judging your grammar silently. Finally today, some of you may remember the 1990 World Cup in Italy and this aria by Puccini, performed by Luciano Pavarotti, Nessun Dorma, Let No One Sleep. It became the triumphant song of practically every World Cup victory that year, even went to number one on the pop charts. Now along comes America's Got Talent finalist Daniel Emmett. He's no Pavarotti, but he definitely holds his own. And Emmett produced his own Nessun Dorma for these times.
No corona, no corona.
Listen closely. It's not just a spoof. Emmett came up with some good, really smart lyrics, and you don't even need to translate the libretto.
The days are getting longer, my cabin fever stronger. All due to bad spit on my couch now, I must sing in my pajamas.
And now the chorus looks ahead to the future. Daniel Emmett did a brilliant job with his Nessun Dorma. You can see his video for Nessun Dorma a la Corona, as he calls it. You'll find it on our Twitter. Our handle is simple. We're at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Rise again, Vincere.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.